The Kinship of Catholics and Jews is a program sponsored by the Institute of Judeo-Christian Studies, Seton Hall University. I'm Father Lawrence Frizzell. I'm the director of the Institute and moderator of this program. With me today is Ms. Marianne Hobby, who is a former resident of South Orange and certainly a great friend of Seton Hall University. Marianne, I welcome you to join me today for this interview. I have fond memories of you and your daughter, Eva, coming to the Seton Hall Chapel many years ago. And so tell our listeners about some of the recent developments in your work.
Thank you, Father. Yes, I have wonderful memories as well. My work today, I would call myself primarily a chaplain out in the woods. We left South Orange 2.5 years ago. I became a board certified chaplain, had worked in hospitals, but out here I don't drive, there's no transportation. So my focus has been over time on working with women that come call on the phone. Also, our hope was to open this as a retreat house for Women's Days of Reflection. However, COVID kind of got in the way of that here and there. And writing. Prayer, writing, caring for a grandbaby. But my writing, my prayer focus has been since January. I've just put a lot of energy into reading the Psalms and such. And my writing just keeps evolving and I don't know where it'll go, but I'm a person who just listens to the quiet voice within.
Wonderful. And so I hope that you can tell us a little bit about this dimensions of your work as we discuss some of the challenges and the burdens that you have faced in years gone by, and so your current work and the book you've just written will refer back to that time of trial that you suffered. And so we realize that the shadow of suffering takes many forms in any person's life. And certainly you have made a dramatic recovery from your very great illness, and for which, of course, we're very grateful. So if we could ask you to tell a little bit about that background experience that would then lay the foundation for your current work and your publication.
Certainly, the experience that I had, which was being a strong, in shape, fit athlete one morning, and then waking up the next morning, not being able to swallow, and waking up 3.5 months later, paralyzed from the neck down, or it's called a tetraplegic, vent dependent, C4 to C7, incomplete. I call it, it was really a journey of transformation. I spent a total of, 8 months in the hospital, different institutions. And it was really a transformative experience in that I lost all that was my identity. I was stripped of all the things that made me who I thought I was. I had no more titles, you know, wife, grandma, professor, student, athlete, gone, zero. I was totally dependent to have my teeth brushed, to have to be turned. I was so broken. I was so ill. Originally, they thought that I was going to die. And then if I was supposed to spend the rest of my life in a nursing home, so who knows? And here I sit today speaking with you in a life that's fuller than any I'd ever thought I would have. By losing all the things that I thought were so important to me, I was able to craft a new identity, but the I didn't do it myself. I was in community because I was lifted up by invisible prayers from Seton Hall, from my parish church, from people who loved me, and I was dependent on the people around me. I called my aides angels with rubber soles. They would come into the night and take care of me, and nothing was beneath them. And they Those people could have torn my dignity apart, shredded me even more, but they never did. They only offered me hope and encouragement. So during those months, I went from completely focused, just trying to live and breathe. And then I got stronger and I could turn to the people around me. And the wonderful part about hindsight and in writing the book was painful, because when I did work with an editor at the end, she was always asking me to go deeper, which was difficult to do. So there was a lot of processing and changing and looking at the emotions. But yes, I think I've emerged a completely different human being with a lot of depth that I didn't know that I had, because I'm not the only one that suffers trauma. And all around me, all of us did. We became a community, you know, of spinal cord injury, SCIs. And that just kept extending. So that when I left the hospital and I eventually became ambulatory, I could walk on my own. I saw life so differently. I saw life so differently. And today's limitations I have are minimal. I often think of my friends that are still on sip and puff wheelchairs. So I know that God saved my life. I was willing at one point, only memory, I have 3.5 months that are totally a blackout, but I have a memory where I hear a voice and I said, God, I'm not ready to go home yet. I don't want to leave my husband, my daughter, my brand new grandbaby, my Seton Hall students, my church kids. I don't, but if you want me, I'll go home. And the voice answered, I'm not finished with you yet. I have work for you to do. That's what I'm here for, Father. I didn't recuperate myself. I didn't rise up. This is all being part of community with people's talents and skills. When I was able to walk again, I did go back and volunteer at the rehab hospital I was in. The nurses there asked me to start a spirituality group. And I did that on a weekly basis, became a Eucharistic minister, eventually also went to study for chaplaincy and did that for 4 years in the local hospital. So I'm so blessed to have gone through what I've gone through, and as a chaplain to be able to be with people in the moments of such great pain and agony and fear, and just be presence. To me, it's just being God's presence, a non-judgmental, non-medical presence. So I have a lot of hope. It doesn't mean life stopped being life, because life will always be life, but I'm here to help. I'm here to serve. That's all that I want to do.
And well, thank you, Marianne, for sketching that very terrible time of difficulty for you and for your family. We can say that you have passed through the dark valley that we speak of in Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. And certainly you have been using the Psalms, of course, as part of your prayer and the recognition of the way in which these experiences of yours have been crystallized. I'm glad that you're able to go back to that hospital and you were able to show evidence, obviously, that the good work that's done there in the care of the sick could be a great encouragement, I'm sure, to those people who were currently bedridden and in a time of trial. So you have shared some of your experiences in a book that is called Bringing Comfort, Hope in Times of Suffering. And so tell us a little bit how you came to write this book.
The inception of the book is a rather funny story. A friend from Seton Hall came to me one evening as I was in bed in a nursing home with this beatific smile and said, why don't you write a book? And I looked at her. I'm paralyzed from the neck down. Well, if you just write one reflection a day, it's Advent. So you'd have 30 days of reflection. And I smiled at her thinking, She's a little nuts, but God bless you, you know, and she laughed. However, that pushed me forward to asking the speech therapist if she would help me to dictate onto the iPad that Seton Hall had taken up a collection and given me. So my dictation was so poor, Father, that you couldn't read what I even said. But I set that forth as my mission. Oh, I'm going to write a book and it's going to help other people. My story will help other people. That kept me going. Mm-hmm. When I did that a little bit every day, no matter if I could write or not write. And it went through several different passages and sojourns. And I would think I was finished. And then I'd be told in prayer, start all over again. So that's where that came from. I believe that, you know, the book wasn't mine. The book helped me because I had a purpose, a new purpose. And then the book was to reflect God's love, not Marianne's ego. It was God's love, God's work, community's work of resilience.
So your chapters include one with the title Singing, and it's important, I think, for all of us, especially as we become more elderly, to realize the importance of music in our lives. I think in the old days, at least when I was growing up, we had our own instruments. I was not talented, but my brothers and my sister were very able to provide a lot of music for my mother and myself to enjoy. And of course, the idea of music in a situation of someone who is suffering in a hospital, for example, and so on, can be very helpful. So please describe a little bit what led you to the understanding of the contribution that music can make in tragic situations.
You, being the scholar that you are, understand and see the Psalms for what they are, and see the role of people crying to God, you know, in song over and over, tambourines to celebrate, etc. It wasn't a conscious decision on my part, but I still believe that's the intuition, that's the spirit within me. Because I made a decision. I didn't want to grumble at the poor age that had to turn me every 2 hours. There was so much pain, my body would just shriek, you know? So I began to sing, and I didn't say, oh, tonight I'm going to sing. It just happened. I've been singing all my life, all my life since I was a little girl, and played the piano. And my brothers and sisters would say, play far, far away, but that's another whole story. And, but the music, I love music. I loved church music and folk music and all those things. I think I was a teenager and I played at Seton Hall Student Union once, you know, in high school. But music held, as I said in the story in the book, my brain wasn't at its full capacity when you're under that pain. I couldn't think of all the songs. It was the same repertoire, the first two lines of Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, that my sister later told me our dad used to sing all the time. And then church songs, and over, not even the whole song, just like rote. I couldn't grab any notes. I couldn't open the file cabinet. I couldn't open the score. It would just come, and it helped. Music rescued me more than once.
Yes, well, certainly. Both the music itself and the lyrics of songs can certainly be uplifting. And so this is one of the ways in which I recall when my mother was in the nursing home that there would be groups of people coming in, people who'd have their own musical instruments. And many of them were alert to the fact that music 50 years ago would resonate with the elderly in a nursing home, and that bringing back those memories and so on was, I think, a good part of the the weekly routines of many of the people with whom my mother was living. So old time music then revives our enthusiasm and can hark back to things that are very memorable. Now, one time in your book, you have told about a night nurse who had to perform a very painful procedure. And so that was one of the contexts in which you used music and lyrics.
Yes, and that, all those evenings, somehow the Gloria from our mass came to me, and I would sing it from beginning to end, over and over. I just kept starting it as she worked on me. And when that procedure was finished a few nights later, she said, "Marianne, I got to let you know something. First of all, I sang that all the way home, every single line. And if that was me in that bed, you would have heard me screaming all the way down the hall." So it always made me happy to know that that music was praising our creator, and it helped her tap in. And again, that is, to me, music is a language, it's power, it's healing. It's another whole, you know, it's the birds, right? It's another way, it's another language. And it's very, very important and soothing to the soul.
And the gift of music, of course, is, among other things, is it transcends any one culture, language. There can be a level of communication that goes beyond the words of the lyrics, and the music itself can certainly portray the various moods of any individual or any community. And that's, of course, where the Psalms become very important, because with 150 Psalms, we have every dimension of human life, every part of the vast array of human experiences can be picked up in the Psalms. And so the use of music and the availability of that inspiration to reach out beyond one's own anguish and difficulties to realize that the way to grapple with suffering, as you have mentioned it, is to transform it, as it were, transform the situation through the gift of music. Now, in your book, you also have a chapter called The Mother, which presents another perspective when we consider the terrible problem of suffering in human life. The way in which people around us, around the person who is in agony, how these people are interacting could be very important, I think, for another angle of the of this experience that you have that you've touched upon with us in this interview. So tell us a little bit about The Mother.
That story was so important. In the few years that I was a Eucharistic minister as a chaplain, I had the opportunity of standing beside mothers, and I'm thinking especially in the rehab hospital, watching their college student, their new graduate, their 30-year-old, lying in bed with a traumatic brain injury, or have become gone from an athlete, a ski athlete, to a quadriplegic. And their pain was immense. And I was able to watch it because the mother was always there. And a mother, when she has an infant, right, it feeds the child, changes the child, brings the child up. And now this 20, 30-year-old has become infantilized, but in a body that's still 18 to 30 or something years old. Yet, so they need all the medical help they can get. The mother becomes the advocate. The mother becomes this cheerleader and carries so much pain in her heart. watches as the outside world recedes because all the friends want to come and visit, but they get these looks on their face and become awkward and most disappear because they don't know what to say. They have strength beyond. They're often so isolated. And that is my heart's desire, was to be able to have those mothers meet with each other and know that they're not just alone. Because not only would their child be in the hospital, I'm saying child, young adult, but they also often had a family at home. And so that family is impacted by the illness. Because all, of course, the family dynamics are disrupted. And mother's attention's over there and not over here. And it's such an agonizing, oftentimes too, that sometimes mothers couldn't be there because they had little ones or children with special needs. And the tensions are so hard on parents with traumatically injured young people, adults, and then even back in the community.
And so the role that you have now is the chaplain, and that was for some time you were able to visit in the hospitals and bring the sacraments to the Catholics who were suffering. But you also were able to observe so many situations in which, as you say, the family members, and especially the mother, could be torn with regard to how to fulfill responsibilities and how to be available, especially to the person who is suffering and who is alone in a tragic illness or accident. And so so these are ways in which certainly your work is pointing to the manner in which we ordinary folks could try to be empathetic, enter into an appreciation of how any illness, any suffering, and even the situations of COVID, of course, which have now sort of thrust themselves upon us in so many ways, these situations can be met with a sense of openness to how maybe we could be of some help to those around us, especially those who are trying to care for the person who is gravely ill. And so there might be volunteers in a family like that who could take care of the ordinary needs of the little children or the ones who seem to be abandoned, as the mother is focusing on the needs of this child who is gravely injured. And so so we could all face the question of how, in some simple ways, we might be able to help.
There you go.
And now I have noted another one of your chapters is emphasizing the idea of that we need help at times, and that's called the shoelace. So tell us a little bit about that episode in your book.
I just loved writing that story. I get such joy from that story. When I was still almost ambulatory, I had started to go up to campus a few days a week, and I was writing up there because campus is my other home. And I would get a ride from an aide, or in this particular case that day, my husband would drop me off at the one point on campus, and I would go up a ramp, and I would push my wheelchair at that point. And this one particular day, it was a summer day, I'm walking along, and I was just soaked in the lush and beauty all around me of the green of our beautiful campus. And you've got to remember, I'm a person who lives for being outside, and I was inside for 8 solid months. So just loving the beauty that was all around me. And I was pushing my wheelchair, and my head doesn't move much at this point, but I could look down and I said, oh, and lying down on the ground, straight out from my instep, were an untied shoelace. Now, big deal, right? Just bend over and tie it. Impossible for me at that point, because I couldn't even keep my balance going forward. I was scared, but I knew what I was supposed to do. I was like, God, you got to help me out of this one. Lord, I really need some help here. And there had been some students that were laughing and went past me, you know, back off to their lunch, summer students, whatever group they were with. But then there was no one. I said, well, Lord, I'm not going anywhere. And then I heard something, because I've developed a very acute sense of hearing. Now, I can't just swivel my head around, but eventually I turned my whole body around. And on the edge of my peripheral vision there was a priest that I knew from the community. And a priest I greatly respected as a scholar. Maybe I was slightly intimidated by at times. And I thought, okay, Lord, you got to ask, help me. What am I supposed to do? And he approached me, and I just came out with a joke about Holy Thursday. And Holy Thursday in the Catholic tradition, we have a practice where people bow down, you know, they wash the priest, the priest wash the feet of different people in the congregation. And so I quipped something about it's Holy Thursday. So I looked down as best I could, and Father, he just didn't skip a beat. He put his books down on the ground and knelt down and tied my shoe. I got to tell you, what a moment of humility to have somebody kneeling down and tying my shoe. Now, it's different to be in the hospital. It's different to have your aide, but this is somebody else. And I said, oh, thank you so much, Father. And I said, you know, go ahead. I walked so slowly. Oh, and he acted just as if he walked this way all the time. And so I asked him about his work and what he was doing. And we parted ways at the library. And I said, happy Holy Thursday in July when we left.
So you have many memories that you've incorporated into this book, Bringing Comfort, Hope in Times of Suffering. And this book is published by Westbow Press. Tell us a little bit about Westbow. I don't know that publisher.
They are a division of the Thomas Nelson and Sonderman. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so that they're a division of them. So little known. But they focus on Christianity. But for me, this isn't about just Christianity. This book is about the resiliency of the human spirit, about connection, about dependence upon our Creator, however we define that.
So Thomas Nelson and Zondervan in Bloomington, Indiana.
There you go.
This is the publisher of your book, and you have beautiful illustrations, and you are certainly giving us many insights, as we've discussed in our program. So, Marianne, I wish to thank you very much for joining me today for the Kinship of Catholics and Jews, and I invite our listeners to be with us again next Sunday